I got so bad that I could barely walk. The breathlessness I had and no energy, and I couldn't sleep at night. I couldn't put my head down on the pillow. I had to sit up just to breathe. I'm on quite a lot of medication now, but gradually it has improved. It's quite difficult to think back 3 years. I call it my previous life, because lots of things have changed in my lifestyle.
That was Heidi, one of 900,000 people in the UK thought to live with some degree of heart failure. In today's programme, I'll be looking at how the latest technology is used to spot the condition, often before the patients themselves know there's anything wrong with their heart. And I'll be finding out how heart failure is treated, from simple but effective self-help measures like graded exercise, to a promising drug still in the pipeline, and a new type of pacemaker. My guest today in the studio is Dr. Martin Thomas, a specialist registrar at the Sussex Cardiac Centre. Martin, before we talk about what goes wrong in heart failure, perhaps we should start with what happens when the heart's beating normally. Talk me through a heartbeat.
Okay. The heart is a muscle. It has four chambers, the two upper chambers, which are called the atria, the two bottom chambers, which are called the ventricles. And the heart is split into two sides, the left and the right. The left side of the heart supplies oxygenated blood to the organs of the body, and the right side of the heart supplies deoxygenated blood, that's blood with no oxygen in it, to the lungs to pick up its oxygen.
So the atria are actually acting as priming pumps, really, for the large, powerful ventricle.
They top up the filling of the bottom chambers.
Now, how's the... I mean, it's a huge muscle. It has to contract in a coordinated fashion to make all that work properly. How's the contraction initiated?
There's a very fine network of essentially electrical cables through the heart, which end up giving a coordinated electrical signal throughout the heart, resulting in a coordinated contraction which is synchronized, so the left and the right ventricles work at the same time, ensuring an adequate pump output to the heart.
It's so complex. I mean, in fact, what's amazing is that it works as well as it does without letting us down. But what's actually happening when the heart fails?
Essentially, the pump of the heart starts to fail, and this just means that not enough oxygen is delivered to the tissues of the body. And as a result, you end up with a lot of problems throughout different organs.
So in heart failure, the heart is not pumping enough, it's become inefficient, it's not meeting the demands of the body. What are the common causes?
The top one in the UK would be ischemic heart disease. That's coronary disease, angina, heart attacks.
Furring up of the blood supply to the heart.
Furring up of blood supply, resulting in not enough oxygen going to the muscle of the heart, so it becomes scarred, thinned, and therefore cannot contract. The other major one would be hypertension, high blood pressure, which means that the heart becomes thickened and just can't pump so well.
That's because it's having to work against the higher than normal pressure.
It's just the same as if you were trying to exercise and you're trying to push blood against greater resistance in the blood vessels, and the muscle of the heart becomes thicker as a result.
And that stops it working as efficiently.
Yep. And then there would be a more general batch. There's a group we call the idiopathic cardiomyopathies, which are a group of conditions where at present we don't know the exact nature of why the heart starts to fail. And then there are other causes if you have valve disease, so that the chambers are separated by valves, and if they start to fail, you can get dysfunction of the heart muscle again. Things we do to ourselves, one of the major things would be over alcohol consumption, and this essentially poisons the heart muscle.
What about symptoms? Because at the lower extreme, you might not have any symptoms at all, but at the other extreme, it can be a very debilitating illness, can't it?
To start off with, I mean, some people, if you look at their heart, the function of the heart is quite poor and they may have no symptoms at all. The most common symptom would be breathlessness when you exert yourself, and also fatigue, tiredness, not being able to do what you would normally do, and fluid retention.
Swollen ankles.
Swollen ankles.
Yeah.
And also if fluid retention starts to develop in the lungs, you become more breathless as a result of that.
And that classically presents at night initially, doesn't it? People find it difficult when they lie flat, they notice that
the absolutely. And the reason for that is when you lie flat, more blood sloshes back to your heart and your heart just can't cope with that and you become breathless.
Now, what about diagnosis? Obviously, we get a clue from the story. We can examine the patient. We can do electrical tests and ECG, and we can do a chest X-ray, all of which can point towards problems. But the definitive way is to use ultrasound.
Yes. All the things you mentioned give us clues, but the way to actually look to see whether the pump of the heart is working properly is by what's called an echocardiogram, which is an ultrasound device that most people would recognise as pregnant ladies having a look at their babies. It uses exactly the same techniques, but slightly enhanced to look at the contraction of the heart and also flow dynamics.
So instead of looking at the baby, we're looking at the heart. Well, Dr. Rachel James is a consultant cardiologist at the Royal Sussex County Hospital. I joined her at a busy morning clinic where, before introducing me to someone with heart failure, she rather wisely decided to remind me what a healthy heart looks like.
This is probably the most easily interpretable. This is the four-chamber view. It's a bit like a Valentine cut through the heart. And these are the two chambers, the main pumping chambers of the heart, the left and right ventricles, with the two atria. And here we can see the normal elliptical or egg-shaped left ventricle with good function, and all the walls are contracting equally.
And it's very easy to see, isn't it? It's just a pure cross-section right across the middle.
Yes. And we can see a real-time moving image with the heart in three dimension. And this has been a major step forward in the field of echocardiography. And this builds up a sort of cast, it's a mathematical model, of the heart moving.
There's a massive difference between, that surprises me. I haven't seen an image like that before. I mean, what sort of percent? The heart almost looks like it's almost doubling in size.
Yes, this lady has an ejection fraction of 65%. That's a measure of the overall pumping action of the heart, and it's pumping well. Can also look at little different segments of the heart and how they're moving in relation to one another. We divided up the left ventricle, the main pump of the heart, into say 16 segments, would expect them to all contract at the same time and relax at the same time, and this is shown here graphically. It's a curve over time.
So if part of the muscle is not contracting in a coordinated fashion, that could be presumably either because there's some problem with the electrical supply to it or the muscle itself.
Absolutely, or a component of both. Right, so can you sit nice and well up in the couch? Keep going.
More? That's maybe better.
Right, sir, some cold jelly on the probe, so it may be a little bit nippy, and I do need to press. We look at the four chamber, the Valentine cut through the heart that we saw the last compared to the normal. Here we see, first of all, a dilated left ventricle. It's much bigger than the person with the normal function. It's also somewhat changed its shape. It's lost that elliptical and it's much more a sort of globular or football shape. And the whole thing has a sort of rocking appearance rather than contracting down.
There isn't a lot of contraction going on,
no,
is there?
It's no. One very common thing when the ventricle is so enlarged and abnormal is for there to be a leak on the valve that's related to that chamber, which is the mitral valve, and you get regurgitation, which also can affect breathing.
So that's effectively blood flowing backwards through the heart. So the valve's there that when the ventricle contracts, it shoots blood out of the heart rather than back up into the priming chamber, the atrium.
So you've not only not got good flow from the ventricle due to the pump abnormality, but you've also got a backflow. And
proportion of that's going the wrong way.
Absolutely. Right, so this is 3D echo now, so it's done in real time. We can see the ventricle beating, but in three dimension. And if we look at the little different areas of segments, so this is looking at the movement of different areas of the ventricle. The ventricle is arbitrarily divided into 16 segments. We're looking at the movement of one segment in relation to the other. The most notable thing is that it's compared to the other ventricle, it's highly discordant. So at times where you've actually got contraction, we've got areas even moving in an outways fashion rather than actually contracting.
So while some fibres are being contracting, some are being stretched up.
Absolutely.
And can you tell the difference by looking at an echocardiogram as the actual underlying cause of that disruption?
We can sometimes if we see an area of thinning or scarring that would suggest that the patient's had a heart attack in that area, or areas of muscle which are not working as well in a particular territory, it may suggest underlying coronary disease.
Dr. Rachel James in the echocardiography suite in Brighton. You're listening to Case Notes. I'm Dr. Mark Porter, and I'm discussing heart failure with my guest, cardiologist Martin Thomas. Martin, presumably in most cases of heart failure, the underlying cause, such as damage to the heart wall from a heart attack, is irreversible, so it can't be cured.
In some cases, it can be cured. I mean, there are few cases, but if you have valve disease, so there's a blockage between the two chambers of the heart, causing a restriction to flow, by surgically correcting that, you can cure the condition. But in general, it's not. So we have to do things to try and improve overall quality of life.
Well, let's start right at the beginning. I mean, what can the patients do to help themselves?
They're very general things. They can reduce the amount of salt they take in their diet. They can cut down the amount of fluid they take in. They can improve their diets. And one of the good things that's coming along is some exercise that will improve matters.
And what's the evidence that those self-help measures make any difference?
There are definitely some studies coming along showing the benefits of exercise programs in outcome from heart failure.
Well, Dr. Malcolm Walker, consultant cardiologist at the London Heart Hospital, heads up such a study and is currently investigating the benefits of exercise in people with heart failure.
One of the non-medical aspects of care for patients with a heart failure, with a pump that's not efficient, is to make them fitter. They do better.
What sort of degree are we talking about?
It's very variable, but what's dramatic is that the patients most seriously affected are the ones that notice the biggest benefit, and perhaps that's not surprising. Those individuals that could barely walk a few yards suddenly find that they're able to contemplate socialising, leaving their home, go out, do shopping, do the normal things of life. One particular patient involved in this study, who was a patient I was looking after, was on a waiting list for cardiac transplantation, and at his own request was taken on off that list because he felt perfectly well enough now to resume normal activities and life.
What's actually going on? Is it affecting the heart or is it the rest of the body that's benefiting from this?
This is a difficult point which is not fully established. I think clearly in the shorter term what's happening is that you're making the skeleton, the musculoskeletal system, the muscles in particular, stronger. So the body is more efficient, so it demands less of the heart for any degree of exercise. And that has a huge advantage to a heart that perhaps is not pumping efficiently.
Okay, clock starts now, everyone. You're doing your swimming action. Breaststroke action, Jim.
Judith Walker is the Cardiovascular Health and Rehabilitation Coordinator at University College Hospital, where the exercise classes are held.
They come along to us for 12 weeks. They come once a week in the afternoon, and during that time they'll be, as you can see, doing some very simple exercises, and it all varies because some of them are more capable than others, so that's very much down to the initial assessment that we do beforehand.
So you can tailor the program towards the individual?
Yes.
In a class,
yes.
I mean, we've got 10 people here today or thereabouts.
Yes,
there's quite a lot of difference in
yes,
what they can actually do, and indeed in their ages as well.
That's very true. And one way of actually being able to assess or putting your patients into categories of risk is by really performing something called a 6-minute walk test, which is very simple, that we do at the beginning of the patients coming onto the exercise program. And a good guide is if they can do more than 200 metres on a 6-minute walk test, then normally they're quite capable of doing an exercise class, as you can see today.
Foot coming firmly up onto the step and lift up with the other leg, excellent, and back down again. Hand on lightly for balance.
So they're starting off over here. What are they doing there? They're just lifting, they're bending the legs at the knees, basically, just kickbacks.
Yes, that's right, kickbacks. So this is actually strengthening the big quadricep muscles on the top of your legs. So we're teaching them to do them in the gym, but we're actually teaching them to incorporate them into their lifestyle at home so they can watch the TV and do their leg raises.
I do an hour's exercise every morning now.
So you come to the class once a week and you're doing something every day at home as well?
I do an hour, yeah, I do between 7 and 8 in the morning.
And now that you're starting to do exercise, are you finding that it's improving your stamina?
Yeah, well, yeah, definitely, yes, and I can sleep a lot better.
Two stretches forward.
Oh, just will help me, yes. Yeah, as soon as I master the kickback, it's a bit of a struggle.
A little bit of a coordination problem, have you?
It's a struggle on the back muscles.
I'm glad you're benefiting from it.
Oh, God, yes, yes. I may have to run away from the wife. When she wants the wages, I run away.
We did a national survey recently, and most rehabilitation programs, which were set up primarily to deal with people following heart attack and heart surgery, will aspire to provide the service. But at the moment, it's very, very patchy, and there are very few units that have been able to build it into the standard care of heart failure patients. We hope that's going to change. As more and more information gets out there, people become confident that this is safe, it's practical, it yields very good results. It will develop and be much more widely taken up.
Do you retest them at the end of the program to see whether their physical endurance has improved?
Yes, we do. We do functional tests. We do a simple 6-minute walk test. It's not a huge improvement, and it may not be truly reflected in the 6-minute walk test, but what you will find is their physical activity diary that they're filling in at home, they actually are doing a lot more than they did when they first came.
What about the socio-economic side? I mean, looking at it from the hospital's point of view, investing in a programme like yours, I mean, as well as the human benefit in terms of symptom relief, is there actually any evidence that patients, for instance, are better, require less hospitalisation?
There is some evidence to that what we call in medical terms morbidity, that is all the attendant problems that are associated with severe illnesses, that is the amount of time you have to visit your doctor, the number of times you're admitted to hospital with a worsening in your condition, those are significantly improved if people become fitter and are part of these programs. They feel better and, in some respects, less of a drain on the resources. All in all, it's a win-win situation.
Cardiologist Dr. Malcolm Walker. Martin, we've heard about exercise there. What other treatments do we have?
The mainstay of treatment is tablets. And there are three main classes. One are diuretics or water tablets, and the other two are called ACE inhibitors and beta blockers.
Well, let's start with diuretics. I mean, they're simply working, presumably, by reducing the load on the heart, by getting rid of excess water?
Yeah, they're nice simple drugs, get rid of the fluid, but unfortunately they have no improvement in mortality from the condition.
So they might make people feel better, but they're not doing a lot of good for the underlying condition.
No,
they're covering it up.
Not at all.
Okay, moving on to ACE inhibitors.
ACE inhibitors were the new drug that came along that made a significant impact into mortality from people with heart failure. And these work essentially by dilating the blood vessels so there's less pressure on the heart so it can work better.
And these are the drugs that end in ill, aren't they? So it's captopril, enalapril, ramipril, those sorts of drugs. And last but not least, beta blockers. Now, when I was at medical school, beta blockers, you know, sort of like an anti-adrenaline drug, if you like, they actually slow the heart down and make beats, I mean, make it weaker. Why would you be using those in heart failure?
Well, it was a brave person that first introduced them, and it was counterintuitive that these drugs, which would slow the heart rate, would do bad things for the heart muscle. But because of its anti-sympathetic activity, its anti-adrenaline activity, it calms the heart down. Most of its impact is from the reduction in arrhythmias, so funny heart rhythms that cause sudden death in people with heart failure.
So looking at all of those treatments together, we talked about symptom relief versus mortality and morbidity. They obviously make people feel better, one would hope. What sort of impact do they have on things like hospital readmission rates and long-term prognosis?
The ACE inhibitors and the beta blockers have a clear reduction in mortality of around 30%, which is a big figure in this group. However, we do know that the maximum benefit is gained from being on the top doses of all of these drugs.
Which brings me nicely onto the fact that these, along with a number of other conditions now, heart failure is subject to, you know, strict protocols that are often managed by nurses rather than doctors. And that's helped, hasn't it?
Absolutely. The heart failure nurse specialists have become an integral part of the care team for people with heart failure. Not only from an educational point of view, telling the patients what they need to do, but making sure that the tablets are up titrated so they get onto the top doses of all the drugs that they need. And this has a clear impact on readmissions with heart failure, morbidity, mortality, and especially quality of life.
Yeah, nurses are better at doctors than getting patients onto the right drugs at the right doses.
Absolutely.
Often the case, yeah. Well, diuretics, ACE inhibitors and beta blockers form the mainstay of treatment, but there's at least one new drug in the pipeline. Michael Freneau is the British Heart Foundation Professor of Cardiology at Birmingham University and leading research into pahexaline, a drug that works in a very different way to existing treatments.
Pahexaline is a drug which works by switching the fuel that the heart uses to generate its energy. So it switches its fuel from fats to sugars, and that results in more energy production. And presumably that's why when we add it to these existing drugs, it's so effective, because it's working by a different mechanism.
So it's basically improving the efficiency of the heart. What knock-on effects have you noticed in your clinical trials?
Well, the study measured exercise capacity, and there were really very dramatic improvements in exercise capacity. A patient who could only walk slowly on the flat might expect to now be able to climb stairs without too much difficulty. That's the sort of magnitude of benefit.
Where exactly in the pipeline are we? If the trials prove as exciting as you're suggesting, when might the drug be available?
Well, in order for a drug to be readily available to the average doctor in the street, as it were, it has to have been shown in a large trial to reduce either the death rate or the hospitalization for heart failure. That's generally the criterion that's used, and that requires a very, very large study. So we're at the moment trying to negotiate for such a study, and so that's the stage we're at the moment.
Professor Michael Freneau. Drugs aren't the only way to treat heart failure. Advances in pacing techniques now mean that artificial pacemakers can override a diseased heart's natural rhythm and resynchronize poorly coordinated contractions of the ventricles. A technique called cardiac resynchronization therapy. The Royal Sussex County is one of a growing number of hospitals using the technique. Cardiologist Dr. David Hildick-Smith.
In heart failure, research over the last 10 years has shown that if patients have poor heart function overall, particularly if the left ventricle, the main pumping chamber which sends the blood around the body, if they have poor left ventricular function and an electrical abnormality on their basic heart tracing, which shows that the electrical impulse is not going down the normal channels, then they may be suitable for a type of therapy called biventricular pacing, or alternatively called cardiac resynchronization therapy, whereby three leads are used in the heart in order to resynchronize the way the heart pumps. It's an extension of pacing technologies that have been around for 40 years, whereby we use, instead of what is currently used, a single or perhaps two leads to pace the right ventricle in biventricular pacing, there'll be a third lead added to pace the left ventricle.
Mr. Harvey's come in for a biventricular pacemaker. He was diagnosed with severe heart failure 8 months ago.
I was in Conquest Hospital Hastings for 10 days and then I became all right. Then about a month later I was walked back in there again with the same complaint. Now that's four times I've done that. I can't walk like I used to. If I go down the pub I get a taxi to take me down it. Although it ain't far, it's only about 500 yards.
We're all setting up now for the procedure, so Mr. Harvey's lying there reasonably comfortable. So basically at the top of the shoulder there's a little vein there called the cephalic vein which runs in the shoulder groove. We'll be using that for one of the leads, and the other leads will go into the subclavian vein which is just under the collarbone. There we got on screening a silhouette of the heart, you can see, and the lead, the right ventricular lead there is just, at the moment it's in the right atrium, just being advanced down towards the right ventricle. So this bit is all just like it would be for a normal pacing procedure, this is no different. You know, the different bit will come once we've put this lead in and go to try and find the coronary sinus to put that lead in, but this is all as per a standard pacing procedure. So you essentially have a triple-pronged approach to electrical activation of the heart. And this means that instead of a creeping wave of muscular activity, which results in this discoordinate and inefficient working of the heart, actually what you get is three points pretty much simultaneously asking the heart to pump, and thereby you get a much more efficient overall output from the left ventricle in particular. So we're looking for the coronary sinus. I think we've seen a hint of it there. And now we're taking a lubricious wire into the coronary sinus, high up on the lateral wall of the heart. And what we do now is we take a picture with some contrast to see what array of venous tributaries there are for this lead, because we have to choose one of them. So this is one of those moments of truth in a biventricular procedure. Let's go on to Monster Mag. That's what's known as a dearth of suitable veins. What we're looking for is a big vein, and that's sort of distinctly lacking there just at the moment, so we're going to have to search a bit further. Oh, it's lovely. Yeah, that's good. Okay, I was lying. There's a good vein there. I think we'll try that now. See really quite a dramatic benefit, a sort of 30% improvement in people's exercise capacity and 6-minute walk capacity when they've got the biventricular system in. Certainly we're very pleased, you know, locally with the results we've had. We've done this procedure on 90 patients in the last 3 years, and these improvements seem to be well maintained over time. We're sort of waiting in a sense to see the more long-term results. Are you alright? Are you comfortable?
Yeah, I'm alright, yeah.
Good. It's all gone very nicely. We've got all the leads in position, and we're just finally sewing up the pocket now.
It's increasingly a technology which will be more widely available, and there'll definitely be capacity for this to devolve out to the surrounding hospitals. I mean, it's now got to the point where I'm very disappointed if I see somebody in clinic after they've had a biventricular pacemaker and it's really not made any significant difference to their symptoms.
Cardiologist Dr. David Hildick-Smith. Martin, that sort of pacing must be very exciting, but it's only ever going to be offered to a small minority of patients, isn't it?
At this point in time, yes, but I think over the coming years it will be rolled out to far more people with heart failure.
Do you think many more would benefit from it?
Absolutely.
Martin, we haven't really discussed the long-term outlook for people with heart failure. It can be pretty bleak, can't it?
It is. Anywhere between 10 and 60% of patients with heart failure will be dead at a year of their diagnosis, which is a grim figure.
I mean, that compares, it's probably worse actually, than most of the common cancers. When you're talking to people about heart failure, do you think they realise how serious their symptoms are?
No, because their symptoms are quite mild. They're just a bit tired or a little bit breathless. So it's a gradual process of informing your patient as to the severity of their condition.
And what about care in the community? I mean, if you've got cancer and you're not expected to survive a long time, it's quite easy to get the sort of help that you need, the palliative care that you need. But for someone with severe heart failure, in my experience, that can be tricky.
There is no palliative care network for heart failure patients at the moment. There are a few places that are developing this, and it's very useful, but it's not widespread throughout the country.
On a lighter note, heart failure may be incurable in most cases, as we've heard, but a lot of the things that cause it, things like high blood pressure, you know, the furring up of your coronary arteries, those are essentially preventable diseases. Do you think that our current more aggressive intervention to things like diabetes and smoking and high cholesterol levels and treating high blood pressure will have a knock-on effect that eventually we'll see a reduction in the number of people with heart failure?
I think we probably will alter the type of patient that we're getting with heart failure, because at the end of the day, heart failure is the end stage of all cardiac conditions. So although we might reduce the people with ischemic heart disease as a cause, other things will come along and replace that.
So one would hope, though, that people would be developing this condition much later in life than perhaps they are now.
Much later, yeah.
We must leave it there. Dr. Martin Thomas, thank you very much. Don't forget, if you'd like to listen to any part of the programme again, then do visit the website, bbc.co.uk/radio4. Now, at the end of last series, I asked you to send in ideas for this series, either by post or email, and back pain proved a popular choice, so that's what we're doing next week. I'll be finding out when surgery can help and when it can't, and